Coming up next is the Professor James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening, August 24th, 2006. And just to pre-announce the two topics tonight, I'm going to go a little bit deeper into the topic of hurricanes, since this topic is getting tremendous press lately from all fronts. And when you see the press gearing up on a topic, then you know that something is amiss. They want the public to be drummed with whatever misinformation they're trying to put out there. But it's a topic that they're a little worried that the public might find out a little too much about. The public might get a little too wise. And the biggest issue with hurricanes is that they are not formed from warm water, or from the energy out of warm water. They are formed from electrical currents coming down from the ionosphere. And when you realize this, you're one question away from understanding how they are manipulated and who has the capability of manipulating these storms, namely the U.S. Space Command with their laser satellites. So at any rate, Physics Today came out with a big front page article, August edition. National Geographic, front page, killer hurricanes, all about hurricanes. In the August 2006, President Bush about hurricanes, talking about Katrina and that the storms could continue and we're just getting started. You have to understand who's manipulating the storms and why. Last year, of course, we had tremendous hurricane season where they went through the entire alphabet. Of course, the named storms go from A to Z. And with names, and then last year, 2005 season, they actually had to go into the Greek alphabet quite a ways to get names for all the storms. And here we are in August 2006, a much hotter year than 2005, and lo and behold, we're only 2D, with a very minor storm, almost a thunderstorm, that NOAA is calling a hurricane. Or tropical storm, but they're categorizing it along with hurricanes. It's nothing more than a minor thunderstorm out in the Atlantic Ocean, yet they're giving it full-page press. The Weather Channel and CNN have been running simultaneously shows drumming up the hurricane business, as I call it, hurricane industry, and the people who make their money off of being so-called hurricane experts. Anyway, more of that during the main topic of the show. And then also, I'm going to talk about telescopes discovering planets, what it really takes to discover planets, and what you might see if one of these objects comes from afar and into the solar system. I'll talk about some of the recent discoveries, which are what known as Kuiper objects, and all the big hullabaloo about renaming Pluto, whether it should be a planet or not. But I want to get specific about the telescopes that are used to discover these, and you might be quite amazed that these are very small telescopes. One including the 36-inch, one of the 36-inch telescopes, which is small, it's minuscule by today's standard of mega telescopes. But also after some of the recent planets were discovered, the new planets of the 50 or so that are actually out there now, known about, roaming in the outer regions of our solar system, you could actually observe these with a 14-inch amateur-grade telescope. So, but I'll go into some of the details to just give you an idea of what it takes to observe one of these or to discover one of these, and it actually is rather difficult, but once you know where to look, then seeing one of these is Not all that difficult, but the other point is, what would something coming in from a distance at high speed look like? And it turns out that those are much more difficult to observe because they're going to act a little different than just a white dot out there. They're going to gain an atmosphere very quickly as they discharge the solar capacitor and become a big fuzzy object. Very difficult to see with a telescope. So this complicates the issue of seeing what we might call Planet X type objects. Objects that would be new or newly discovered to the solar system. And I just want to reiterate that Planet X is an astronomical term going back to the Middle Ages, simply referring to a new planetary or celestial object that has not been given a proper name to date. So Planet X is an astronomical term, somewhat abused and misused by misinformation campaigns, but sorely misunderstood by the general public many times. Anyway, I will be talking about that. Quickly, a health note, and here is my recommendation to everybody. Get ready to get out of the way when the mad dogs, the crazy people, start their madness in running around, dropping bombs, launching rockets, whatever they do. And there are plenty of people out in this world today who will sell them that and also run around and stir up the trouble to make them shoot bombs, rockets, drop bombs, or whatever they do, the madness. The best thing to do, of course, for most people, is to get the heck out of the way. And in that light, that's my personal recommendation. Just get out of the way and be ready to take care of yourself. Because there's, as I joke with a friend of mine, there's not going to be a big semi that's going to pull up in front of your house full of government goods and say, here, we're going to take care of you. That's simply not going to happen. So be ready to take care of yourself. And the main item that you're going to need, of course, food, some clothes to wear for an extended period, but water, a glass of fresh water, a little couple gallons of fresh water, the biggest thing you may need. And that's why I've put the Berkey filter on my list of items that you can procure through this show, through my webpage, and also by mail order. And I was quite surprised that people are using all of these methods to respond to what I'm talking about, and they're getting their Berkey filters. And so I have this offer where I'm sending out a free shortwave radio, an emergency radio, free along with the Berkey. It's one that I use myself and take on trips. I've used this in the far distance areas of the planet to pull in stations that even the big radios sometimes had a hard time pulling in. It runs on 2A batteries. It's a Bell & Howell world receiver. It has an AM/FM band, AM and FM bands, a TV band, so you can listen to TV stations, and it has the full range of shortwave frequency bands, the various meter bands for shortwave. Anyway, the offer is a Berkey water filter with not just two filter elements, but four. Two extra, because in an emergency you're going to need those extra ones, and I will only sell them with the extra. The manufacturer of the Berkey sets the price, so I can't change that. So what I do is offer you free shipping and the free Bell & Howell emergency shortwave radio. And the shortwave radio, by the way, is sent out separately from the Berkey, so people will get their Berkey as a separate item, and then the shortwave radio will be sent separately. You'll get both of those. But anyway, here's the three ways to obtain this. And 800, there's an 800 number, and all of the information is on a recorded message when you call this 800 number, and also then there would be operators after the message. 800-983-5622. That's 1-800-983-5622, or the same using letters, 1-800-983-JMCC, my initials. Also on that offer, for people who are yet to discover my books or want to get started, I've put together what I think is an amazing offer. It's my three book set, the Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes book, the second book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, the third book, my weather book, which is extremely important, and by the way, which you should be reading if you want to know what really causes hurricanes and how they work, related to the electrical nature of our solar system. And then also the pamphlet, Surviving Planet X Passage, something that I recommend that everybody get because it shows you how to build a calendar and timepieces, regain the calendar and the clock even after a pole shift using just a pile of rocks. And then also with the four books, I have two videos, the two videos I made at the UFO Congress in 2003 and 2004, one dealing with my life work, kind of a summary, and in 2004, the video, Electric Highways to the Stars, dealing with electromagnetic propulsion systems, and also the free Bell and Howell radio, with that offer for only $89. That's also at the 800 number. And also at my website, now I have a new designation for my website. My full website name is jmccannyscience.com, but I have an abbreviated form for people who, because a lot of times they misspell that, and you don't want to end up at some of those other sites trying to somewhat duplicate my name. So here is the abbreviated form to get to my website, www.jmccscom. www.jmccscci.com. And mail order, JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392. If people just want the weather book, the 800 number only has the Berkey offer and the $89 book and video special offer. But the web page, you can look there, and it has a whole range of the books and the videos and the CDs. It's too much to talk about here, so I'll go on to tonight's show topic. And just to remind people, those radios are sent out separately from the Berkey filters. That is my personal offer, so I send those out separately. Just a quick couple notes, because politics are gearing up in the world, and I like to keep away from politics on this show. And I know people tune into this show to listen to science, so I try and gear these topics towards science. Just a little note, you know, a long time ago, I mean, after the first caveman walked out of one cave, and another caveman walked out of another, and they started throwing rocks at each other, the first what you might call war, they should have probably at that point sat down and said, let's limit our war to something, maybe a stick of the following size. This is the biggest thing you can use in warfare, and may the better man win. And then it would be something like, what if in football or in baseball or any other, say, sport, say in football, one team could go into go and get some kind of secret weapon that's much, equipment or use pads, you know, or something like that that were much advanced over the other teams. And every week you'd see a team come out with bigger and more colossal weapons to use in the football game. This is what goes on with war. And so because of this one-upmanship, there are a number of things that happen. First of all, it employs a lot of scientists. A lot of scientists. In fact, it employs all of the scientists. All of our scientific resources in the United States literally go into warfare. All of the good science goes into warfare. And if you think about that for a minute, you go, oh, gee, there's a lot of scientists that I know work at a university, or, gee, they work at this company over here. But all of that ends up going into warfare. Think about it. So without these advancements in science, modern warfare would be, well, they'd be throwing sand and rocks at each other instead of nuclear bombs, smart bombs, guided missiles, electronically controlled warfare, laser beams, and et cetera, et cetera. So the point is that, number one, scientists create the madness of war, the modern madness. Number two, and most importantly, it keeps the people who wage war in power. Very simply, where would those people be if we had a designated war area, say out in the middle of the Sahara Desert, where there's nothing out there except hot sand, and that's where people had to go to do what we would call war, and they could only use a stick of a certain size, and that's all that they could use. And if they really want to go have war, let's make the leaders be the first guy out on the field. So at any rate, you can see how science has been used for two things, for one-upmanship in the quest for a better warfare machine, and number two, and more importantly, to keep the masters of war in power. It also makes a lot of money for these companies that employ the scientists. So at any rate, when you see that we have been controlled around the world for many hundreds of years by the same groups of people, the same people that are running the United States now, the Bush-Clinton White House, as we have come to call it, etc., you find that these people are kept in power and have been in power because of science and technology. The other issue with science, which I found out the hard way when I was out in California dealing with back in the early 80s, dealing with the aerospace industry and my own small business dealing with electromagnetic propulsion systems, etc., what I learned is as soon as a technology comes out, it is harbored by the developing nation for only a short period of time, and then almost about as fast as you can blink, those technologies are moved to the opposing country. And you would think, well, why would anybody do that? Well, it's because then that drives the business of war and war production and development of warfare equipment. It drives it so that you always have to have a next generation, one that's bigger, than one that's better, one that's faster, one that has more electronics, etc. And this drives an incredible business called the war industry. So you see that scientists, in their stupidity, if it weren't for the scientists and engineers, all of whom really are working under these systems, there wouldn't be any advanced warfare. Because the guys who are running the show, the guys on top, the Bushes, the Clintons, Hillary, Bill, George Sr., George little George W., who couldn't run a pop stand in Texas if he didn't have all of his support system, these people would be nothing. If you look at the Carlyle Group, these people don't develop science or technology. They own it. They use it. They manipulate it. They create hatred around the world so that they can stay in power. So scientists are the crux of this, and that's why I refuse to work for government-supported science. And if you really look at it, it's not government, because the government is really controlled by a very few people. And along somewhat the same line, I just want to remind you that your next president, if you're in the United States, has already been chosen. It's Hillary Clinton, and the next president after that will be Jeb Bush. What you now come to understand is that ever since Kennedy's was assassinated, and by the way, he wasn't assassinated by the populace, he was assassinated by people, obviously, within the CIA, and ever since, the people in the background, the Kissingers, the Bushes, etc., have been behind the scene operating our government. And the people in the presidency have been simply their go-to guy, their front man, so to speak. And this goes on today. So if you think we live in a democracy or that there's an election coming up and that your vote counts for something, I suggest that you sit down and take a hard look at what is really going on. Just a quick note, I got a call yesterday from a person I'm on his show quite regularly, one of the talk show hosts, one of the very popular daytime talk show hosts, and asked me a question. He said he got an email stating that Mars would be the closest to Earth on August 27th, in so many thousands of years, Mars would have its closest approach to Earth, and would there be any calamity or whatever? And I explained that, first of all, let me make it very clear, Mars is nowhere near its closest approach of Earth in its orbit. Mars is literally on the other side of the solar system from Earth at this time. And August 27th, that date really is of a number of years ago. In fact, I was on many, many radio shows prior to that. One of my weather predictions dealt with that date because of not only the alignment of Mars electrically with Earth, but there was lunar alignments and other planetary alignments. And so you can read about that in my weather book. I'm not going to go into more detail on that. But so who is propagating this confusion about August 27, 2006 being a close approach of Mars? I have not gotten to the bottom of who has been propagating this. But there's some people out there who have nothing better to do, and there's some people who actually make their living sending out misinformation for the government. So whatever, wherever you got it from, ignore it. And now to the weather topic. First of all, a little bit of a summary of weather this week. We had a couple small spurts of somewhat minor severe weather across the United States. Nothing that amazing. But in the Pacific, we've got two almost hurricanes, Ioki and Ileana. I'm not sure how to pronounce that one. Ileana. And they are moving, Ileana moving up the Pacific west coast of the United States, probably will dissipate shortly. Ioki has moved out south of the Hawaiian midway chain, moving westerly and apparently dissipating fairly rapidly. Also with winds under 90 miles per hour, so just on the verge of being a Category 1 hurricane, each of those, for a brief period of time. Once again, if this is the hottest year on record, and we've had tremendous heat this year, as you know, then where are all the hurricanes? I mentioned that a little earlier in the show. In the Atlantic, we are only on the letter D. By this time last year, we were well on our way through the full alphabet. So Tropical Storm Debbie is out in the eastern Atlantic, coming off of Africa, and I would not qualify this at all as a tropical storm. It is not spinning. It has a 1,002 millibar pressure cell in the low pressure cell, and this would not qualify by anybody's standard as a tropical storm. So why all the front page press? Why all of the internet press on the channels like CNN and MSNBC, etc.? Somebody is drumming this up because there simply are no storms. the wind speeds in Debbie are only 35 to 40 miles an hour. I mean, we've had bigger storms right where I live here, bigger thunderstorms than that. So I have defied, in honor of Noah and its inept team of so-called experts, I've decided to define a new term. It's called the Noahcane. And it's an improbable storm. It's a storm that isn't a storm, but it's being built up to be a storm. Noah faking data to get some numbers on the board, supposedly, because they predicted another monster hurricane season. And we are well through the heart of the hurricane season, and we're only on the letter D, and they're naming minor thunderstorms as tropical storms, just to get some on the board. So there you have it, folks, a Noahcane. That's a storm that really isn't a tropical storm. It's certainly not a hurricane, but Noah needs some points on the board to get their statistics up. So, a Noahcane. Debbie is a Noahcane. But on to the topics of all of this hype and press about hurricanes. National Geographic, August. Killer Hurricanes, the cover with a picture of a hurricane. Physics Today, August issue, cover, hurricane thermodynamics, trying to tell you how hurricanes develop. And the first thing, of course, it talks about is the greenhouse effect, the alleged system that drives heat from the cooler clouds down to the warmer planetary surface of Earth. But the entire problem here is, since we're supposedly in the hottest season or hottest year temperature wise in history, almost certainly one the hottest year of record in a very long time, where are all the hurricanes? By July 7th of last year, 2005, we were already through the D's. But there is a kind of a consortium of scientists who are promoting this warm weather, warm water hurricane model, and it simply doesn't hold water. They talk about a Carnot engine, which is a heat engine, driving the hurricane cycle, but I really love the way in the Physics Today article, how they just kind of hand wave over the origin of the cyclic motion of the hurricane. They just kind of say, well, they leave that up to random motion in the clouds. In other words, they don't have a sound theory for how the vortex rotating motion of the hurricane even begins. So without that, you really don't have a storm or storm development system. Now, let me just use a couple of simple examples here of the problem with the warm weather model for hurricane development. We know for a fact that hurricanes have followed other hurricanes in the same path, sometimes as little as a day apart. And the second hurricane over that same patch of ocean has a much stronger cell, much lower depression, higher wind speeds, bigger storm, considerably more energy. So how does this happen if the first storm already had drained the energy out of the ocean? There is a simple calculation that can be made. In fact, Newton used these same methods in many of his experiments to determine, for example, the amount of energy coming off the sun. He used water. Let me give you a simple example. You take a pan of water, boil it on a stove, and then you start to let it cool. Atmospheric scientists would want you to believe that all of a sudden over that boiling pot of water that is now cooling, you've turned the heat off, it's now cooling, they expect you to believe that some very controlled, very organized form of energy is going to form off the energy dissipation coming off that cooling pot of water. Simply not going to happen. The three laws of thermodynamics are very consistent and very well established and very very basic to the understanding that heat systems, as they dissipate in the process of forming entropy in the universe, heat systems simply don't of themselves form nicely organized little patches of energy, such as hurricanes or tornadoes. Some outside force has to organize that energy, and it happens all the time, but you need that outside driving force. In the case of hurricanes and tornadoes, these storms are driven from electrical currents from the ionosphere, which are driven from electrical currents and energy systems that pass by Earth in the solar system, and are driven by the fusion engine, which is in the surface of the sun. So there is a model that makes sense, but it is not the hot water turning into a hurricane model. That model makes absolutely no sense in physics. Also, the conservation of energy principle is violated. I just love this article in Physics Today, how it avoids the main issue with a hurricane. Where does all that energy come from? There is simply not enough energy in that ocean water cooling slightly as the hurricane moves over the water. There's simply not enough energy transfer there to cause the hurricane to form. The hurricane, if it's a much more energetic system, should be driving energy into the ocean, not vice versa. So once the hurricane gets going, how does the mild temperature gradient and change in the ocean drive more energy into the already energetic hurricane? You start to see the fundamental theoretical problems with the warm water theory of hurricanes. Now let's take some concrete examples for the people out there who are really not familiar with some of the technical terms like Carnot cycle and laws of thermodynamics and conservation of energy. There was, let's take Mars. We've seen hurricanes on Mars. There are no oceans on Mars. There's no humidity at a surface. There's no differential surface barrier like ocean, humidity, dry air to drive a Carnot cycle, but we have seen hurricanes on Mars. In fact, we've seen hurricanes on Mars near the polar caps. In fact, we've seen hurricanes on Earth over Antarctica. We have seen hurricanes come up the western coast of the United States and move all the way up past Oregon, Washington State, and up to Alaska, fully formed hurricanes, and NOAA never reported them, and when we called them on it, they simply said, we don't report tropical storms over 30 degrees latitude because they simply don't exist. Well, they do exist, they've been recorded, and NOAA is keeping its head in the sand about such topics. Let's take another storm that I think everybody knows about out there. It's called the perfect storm. There was a movie made about this, and the storm consisted of three hurricanes that joined together in the North Atlantic to form one of the most violent storms recorded in history. The first storm came across the North American continent along the Canadian, U.S.-Canadian border around October 30th, and this is also known as the Halloween Blizzard. I happened to be in that. I believe the year was 1991. Yes, the fall of 1991. The Great Halloween Blizzard dumped 30 inches of snow one day and 36 inches of snow the next day. One of the most unbelievable early storms in recorded history. This was literally a hurricane over land, moved eastwardly and out into the Atlantic Ocean to become one of the storms that joined to become the perfect storm, one of the three storms. So where is the warm water that formed that storm, Mr. NOAA, Mr. MIT professor of atmospheric sciences? and Mr. Physics Today editor, Mr. Weather Channel editor, Mr. CNN Weather or Weather.com editor. Where is the warm water that formed that hurricane? Well, let's take the second hurricane that formed the perfect storm. It came through Appalachia, once again dumping record amounts of snow. It was a tremendous snowstorm, moved up the eastern seaboard and out into the Atlantic to join storm number one that I just described. That was the second storm to join forces to become the perfect storm. The third storm came up from the south and once again continued to gain energy as it moved into the frigid North Atlantic waters. All three storms combined into one, and of course we now call this the perfect storm. Where is the warm water that drove that storm? Now, we've seen many other storms move up into the North Atlantic, and the answer is that these are driven by electrical conditions in the solar system that make their way down to the troposphere, that's our weather system portion of the atmosphere on planet Earth, and these storms are driven from electrical currents literally coming from outer space. Now, that is a scientific explanation that holds water both in terms of conservation of energy, in terms of how the spinning motion of the hurricane develops, because the vortex motion is part of the upward draft that is created by the electrical currents. Now, I'm not going to go into the entire theory here because it's written in detail in my weather book, but the point is that The point I want to get back to is that why August 2006, all of the emphasis on the totally incorrect concept of warm water creating hurricanes? And I get a kick out of the National Geographic cover, No End in Sight, Killer Hurricanes, and then they talk about New Orleans last year, Katrina. But last year, as I said before, we were all the way through the alphabet naming storms and into the Greek alphabet quite a ways before the end of the season. And now here we are in 2006, a much hotter season in terms of temperature, certainly far more than any greenhouse warming would account for. And we're only up to D, Debbie, a minor, when this show goes to press, a minor thunderstorm in the eastern Atlantic that is far too early to even name as a storm, already being named as a tropical storm and being hyped up in the press. Somebody wants the public to completely misunderstand the whole concept of where hurricanes come from, what causes them, and to drive this totally incorrect scientific model of the warm water creation of a hurricane. Why are they so insistent on dumping this totally incorrect idea on the public? As I said many times before, if the public knew exactly how hurricanes formed, that is, from electrical currents from the ionosphere, the public would be one step closer or one step away from asking the question, well, how are they manipulated? And that would point to the U.S.-owned and operated laser satellites that the Space Command manages and uses and used last year to manipulate all of those storms. Wilma, Katrina, Rita, on and on. Let me go through the list of storms last summer that were manipulated, starting Brett, Cindy, Dennis, Harvey, Gert, Franklin, Emily, Irene, Jose, Katrina, Lee, Felipe, Ophelia, a very manipulated storm, Nate, Maria, Rita, a very manipulated storm, Stan, Tammy, Vince, Gamma, Beta, Alpha, and Wilma, a tremendously manipulated storm, on and on. Last year's hurricane season, a season in which probably there should not have been much damage or hurricane activity at all, but in fact there was tremendous hurricane activity, tremendous damage, tremendous amount of controlled activity, and I suspect that the mill boys are very busy over in the Mideast with some other little projects they have going over there. The problems, theoretically, with the warm weather hurricane model, I always get a kick how they add things like, oh, well, it's the salt content of the water now that adds a little bit of punch to the hurricanes. How does salt in water add energy to an already developed hurricane? Once again, it's like asking you, okay, I'll give you an example for the general public. Say you see an automobile driving down the street, you've never seen one before, and somebody points to that and says, what do you think causes that to go down the street? And you look at it, of course you can't see the engine in the car, you don't know what an engine is because you've never seen one before. So you look at the automobile going down the street and you see some exhaust coming out the tailpipe and you go, that must be it. There must be exhaust coming out the tailpipe that makes the car go down the street. That's the equivalent of trying to convince you that warm water is the source of energy for a hurricane. It is that far afield from any reality. Let's take another example. This is a thermodynamics example. You go to your refrigerator on a hot day and you put your beverage in the refrigerator to cool it down, and somebody says, if you leave your refrigerator door open on this hot day, your beverage will get colder in that refrigerator than if you shut the door. Now, think about that. That's what they're trying to tell you with the greenhouse effect, that somehow warmth is pumped from the cooler clouds down to the warmer planetary surface. This is what scientists are trying to tell you, but, of course, not directly. This is what I'm telling you because that's the true scientific interpretation of the greenhouse effect. It simply doesn't work. It's theoretically impossible, on and on. But the whole point of this discussion is, once again, why the coordinated effort. Whenever you see this vastly coordinated effort on all news fronts, I saw it on CNN, just the regular CNN webpage news site, how hurricanes form. As I said, National Geographic front page article, Physics Today front page article. Every place you look in the month of August 2006, you're going to see some reference to how hurricanes allegedly work by warm water. Somebody is spending a lot of time trying to tell you some very incorrect information regarding hurricanes, how they form, and what they want you to believe about them. On to the next topic, dealing with telescopes and the discovery of planets. Now, the reason I want to talk about this tonight, of course, I've covered this topic from many points of view, many aspects, but the reason I want to talk about this tonight is because many people don't really understand what it takes to, in fact, discover a new planet. And over the past decade, we have seen possibly as many as 50 new celestial members of our solar system discovered. And so I want to go into a little bit of detail so you understand how they're discovered, and then move on to the topic of what would happen, what would we see, what could be detected by astronomers with good equipment, what might the public see if an object came into the solar system from afar and all of a sudden this was on a path that came into the solar system, possibly the inner solar system. In other words, a Planet X type object. And remember that the term Planet X is an astronomical term that goes back to the Middle Ages, meaning any celestial planetary type object that has not yet been named. It's not been given an official name. So the term Planet X simply refers to something that as of yet has not been named. So do the following. Imagine that you're a researcher in astronomy and you're going to set out to discover planetary objects in the far reaches of the solar system. Now, take your hand and stretch your arm out all the way. Hold your hand up so you can see your fingernails at arm's length. Now, look at your little fingernail at arm's length, and that is about approximately 1 degree. 1 degree vertically, 1 degree sideways, and astronomers measure the sky in terms of degrees. So you would look at a patch of the sky, say 1 degree by 1 degree. If you held your little finger out and looked at just your fingernail, little fingernail, that would be about 1 degree by 1 degree square. Now take a tenth of that in both directions. In other words, a patch that would be 1/100th the size of your little fingernail. Divide your fingernail up and down into 10 lines and back and forth sideways into 10 columns, and the bottom right-hand corner, that 1/100th of your little fingernail, 1/100th of your little fingernail, would be an area about 6 arc minutes. That's what a modern high-precision telescope sees. That's the field of view, that small angle looking out into space. That's how small a region of outer space these telescopes will cover. Now, imagine a telescope that's 32 inches in diameter. This would be a research grade, not large by any standard, because there are mirrors and telescopes that are 10 meters across, 30 feet in diameter, some larger, but they are typically used for other types of research. The planetary search telescopes generally are relatively small, and you're going to find that after planets have been discovered, with good equipment on a clear night and with a good camera, a good electrical CCD imaging camera on a telescope, you would be able to pick up one of these small planetary objects at the far reaches of the solar system with a 14-inch telescope, basically one that you could buy and own as an amateur. But anyway, let's go back to your professional search for a planet. Now, you'll hopefully have an image of the field of view of a telescope. 1/100th of your little fingernail at arm's length. Now, it takes some time to take that picture. Then you move slightly, so you take the region of sky next to that little patch, then the region of sky next to that little patch, and it's going to take you a long time, as you can see, to take a photograph of the entire night sky. And on any given night, you're not going to be able to see the entire sky, just a portion of it. Now, imagine that somewhere out there is a new small planet mixed amongst the star background. How do you discover that as an astronomer? Well, the answer is, here's what they do. They use a blink comparator technique. And actually, this is done by computer now. But basically, you would take a picture of a small region of the sky, and then a number of hours or possibly a day later, you would take the picture of that same region of the sky, and a small planetary object out there would move relative to the background stars. The background stars would stay in the same position. And so let's imagine that you then could enhance or enlarge that region, that little patch that's as big as a 1/100th of your little fingernail. You could expand it and enlarge it up to the size of a sheet of paper, like an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. You would probably, with your telescope, see between 20 and 100 stars in that region. And then you would, by comparing the picture taken one night with the next night, you would be able to see that little planet, that fuzzy little dot in there, moving back and forth. It would be moving relative to the stars, which are in fixed positions. So this is, in fact, how you would do this. But you have to understand that as you're taking a picture of one region of the sky, that little teeny patch, the planet you're looking for might be way over there. And by the time you get way over there to look where the planet used to be, it has now moved to a new location. So you can understand the very difficult nature of automated searches for planets. But be that as it may, they have discovered as many as 50 of them in the past 10 years. New objects that are big enough to be, say, on the order of magnitude of our moon, or half the size of our moon, and giving astronomers no end to the amount of frustration they have as to whether they should call them planets or some other name. But clearly, they didn't think that any of these should be out there. They didn't, 10 years ago, they would have told you there are 9 planets, nothing else. But here's the quagmire. Here's the problem that astronomers have today. If, in fact, there are new and more all the time planets on varying orbits, all of these objects are not in nice, neat orbits like the rest of the planets. They're in very unusual orbits. So what's the probability that, number one, we're going to find a big one out there, something maybe as big as Earth, maybe something bigger? And number two, what's the probability that one of these objects, possibly a large one, would have an orbit that could bring it into the solar system and the inner solar system and potentially cause havoc amongst the planets? What's the probability of that? It's actually probably quite high that there are objects out there like that. In fact, the ancients, of course, tell us about such objects. Now, when you see these little dots on a plate, on a photographic plate, they're little dots. You can then astronomers look at them with larger telescopes and look at their surface characteristics and take the spectrum of their surface properties, etc. But they are in relatively passive orbits, orbits that are not coming directly in towards the inner solar system, and as such do not discharge the solar capacitor to a great degree. But take an object that's, say, coming in from a great distance, say it's on a, let's say it's on a 100,000-year orbit around the sun. Let's say it's fairly large. Let's say it has an entourage of objects around it. And, of course, many people have heard the idea that there's an object that has a 3,600-year orbit. There is, at present, no physical evidence of an observed planet, at least any that we have been, any information that has been related to the public, that would confirm that in a scientific sense. But let's say there's something out there, and this is hypothetical, something on a 100,000-year orbit, but it's starting to head back in, and it's, let's say it's in the future sometime going to come back into the solar system. What might a generation of people see at that time? And the answer is kind of strange. You might expect it to be a small dot out there. And it might be before it enters into the far reaches of the solar capacitor. If you could see that far, if you had good enough telescopic equipment and you knew where to look. But once it reaches that interface where the solar capacitor ends, which is probably, I estimate now, about 3 times the distance to Pluto, then an object coming in on a very elliptical orbit, coming in almost directly at the sun or the solar region towards the inner solar system, would all of a sudden break into a comet type of atmospheric attraction where the object would discharge the solar capacitor, draw in a small atmosphere, and that would cloud it from view. In other words, you would have to look for a very diffuse, very low light level, very kind of a small but diffuse dot, and this would spread the light out quite a bit. It would also block solar light from getting to the object to make it bright, and so it would be extremely difficult to see an object coming in. It wouldn't look like these little dots or little circles that you see in the telescopes of these objects that are in relatively well-defined orbits, not circular, but certainly not highly elliptical either. Elliptical meaning they go way out and then come back in towards the sun on relatively narrow paths. Circular orbits meaning they're going around the sun with the sun at the center of a circle. So most of the objects that have been discovered so far, except for a few, have relatively benign orbits. In other words, they're not going to come careening into the inner solar system. The point I want to make here is that what would the public see? Well, probably the public would never become aware of these objects by, unless they were told by professional astronomers with extremely, extremely sensitive equipment. And it turns out that NASA is building such a telescope to send into orbit to look into outer space and, in fact, look for these diffuse objects at the far reaches of the solar system. But it's certainly not a very public event. The entire point here is that most people, when they think of Planet X, they think of something round, maybe red, they've heard orange, they've heard various colors. The bottom line is you're not going to see something in the form of a ball or a round object. You're going to see something that looks like a comet. And this is one of the biggest things that the disinformation crew has worked on for a very long time, to try and present this image, whether it's on the cover of phony books or whether it's on the cover or talked about by people who claim to talk to aliens regarding Planet X or something like that. They always want to present the image that this object would be round and keep you away from the concept, which is the true concept, that these objects will come in and appear as large raging comets. Planet X, a big kind of ugly object coming into the solar system, something that could do severe damage to the inner planets, including Earth, would come in the form of a large comet. That's probably the most important point I could make regarding what the public might see. Not all comets become planets. Not all comets are dangerous. Most comets are small, benign, and harmless. But occasionally, large ones could come in that could cause damage. More on this in future episodes. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.